I picked up recently Ken Follett's latest book. It's called Never, and it weighs in at over 800 pages. I didn't actually weigh it, so I have no idea what it weighs. And I was a little nervous because I have, when I do my book reviews, I have mentioned that I don't particularly like long books and that most long books would be significantly improved if they were less long. But the only difficulty involved in finishing Never was finding a way to comfortably balance the book as I lay reading it later and later into the night because I found it so engrossing and fascinating. It is a book which takes a look at the proliferation of nuclear weapons and says, you know what? The notion of this world stumbling towards the unthinkable, which is a nuclear conflagration, it's plausible. It's plausible. And the great skill of the author is making it seem credible and plausible. It involves, obviously, the world's great powers, America and China and Russia. North Korea's in there. There's a lot of stuff happens in Chad. The action begins in the Sahara Desert in Chad. Don't want to give too much of the plot away, but I hope I've sketched the sort of broad base against which the story and the characters unfold. And I'm delighted that the author is on the line to us. And Ken Follett, a very, very, very good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, John. It's great to be on the show.
I read The Eye of the Needle in 1976, which is nearly 46 years ago. You have sold 160 million copies of your books, and many of those books have been sold to people who, like me, have been reading you since 1976. You have a very intimate relationship with many tens of millions of people who've never met you. It's quite a thing to think about, I think.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I think about those millions of books, and I think, what a lot of trees. but it is, as you say, the important thing is all of those readers, all of whom have sort of seen inside my head, and you can't hide much, you know, everything comes out when you write a novel. But the main thing I want to do is say to them, come with me and I'll show you something that I've imagined. It isn't real, but it's very close to reality. And if you come with me, you will find that it's very exciting and intriguing. And although I don't, you know, I don't write books with a message. I'm not in that sort of game. But there's usually something of reality in my books. There's usually something, not a message, but sort of some information, some details that I hope people will find intriguing. That's why I do such a lot of research, so that I can share with readers some of the things that I've learned on the journey of writing a book.
Yeah, it's almost 50 years and almost 50 books, and you don't seem to run out of ideas. You don't seem to run out of stories, not at all.
Not yet. Touch wood. I do find that there are always two or three vague ideas kicking around in my head, and then when I finish a book finally and start to think, what shall I do next? I've got some options, you know, and of course, not all the ideas kicking around in your head are good ideas, and so sometimes I work for a week or two on an idea for a book and realize that it's not good enough. But so far, there has always been one that has turned out to be good enough. And for an idea to be good enough, it's got to be an idea that generates between 50 and 100 dramatic scenes. A novel is a story told in a series of dramatic scenes. And lots of ideas will generate two or three dramatic scenes and then peter out. So I'm always looking for something that makes me think, oh, yes, and this could happen and that could happen and something else and something else and something else, enough to make a book. I mean, it doesn't have to be an 800-page book. I've been writing long books for a while now. And what I think about it, John, and you mentioned that in your intro, and I feel the same sitting in bed reading with a very heavy book. But the thing is, a short novel can be a delight. A thriller or a detective story can be a delight. But I find that I forget those quite quickly. You know, I might really enjoy a book, and a month later, if you asked me to tell you the plot, I would be in difficulty. But when you read a long book, it's with you for a long time. It takes you a couple of weeks, maybe a month or two, to read this story. So you're living with those people all of that time, and their lives become very vivid to you over that time. And I think my experience anyway, as a reader, is that if I really enjoy the long book, it stays with me pretty much all my life.
I often wonder what sparks an idea which then turns into a book. And I didn't have to wonder too long, because you tell us in a preface that the inspiration for Never comes from your research into the origins of World War One for Fall of Giants, which was the first volume of the Century trilogy. So that's been percolating, that's been incubating in your brain for quite a while, because that was, you say, a war that nobody wanted. So you now write about a war that might happen, a nuclear war, which would be a war that nobody wanted, but like the First World War, came about in a series of actions, some of them connected, some of them disconnected, and then all of a sudden there it was, a war which nobody wanted.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and that's what struck me about the First World War. Nobody wanted it. And also, John, none of the presidents and prime ministers and emperors at the time in 1914, none of them were crazy or stupid. This was something that was done by pretty rational people. I mean, the emperor of Austria was old, and the Tsar of Russia was a bit weak, but the Kaiser was a perfectly sensible man. The French prime minister certainly was. The British foreign secretary was Sir Edward Grey, who's generally thought to be one of our better foreign secretaries in history. And they all tried to prevent war. They all wanted to prevent a European war. But they kept making decisions, each of which took us a step closer to war. And of course, I asked myself, could this happen today? And I also realized that this is exactly the structure that you want in a novel. You want the tension to increase by small steps as you go through the book, so that each step that's taken doesn't seem catastrophic. It just seems more or less reasonable. But nevertheless, the danger of a world war breaking out just comes closer and closer. So I saw it as, first of all, as a real possibility, and secondly, as the perfect sort of shape for a good story.
Yeah, I mean, it's, an American soldier is shot dead on the border between Chad and Sudan. The rifle with which he is shot turns out to have been sourced from North Korea. Later on in the book, an oil exploration vessel with American scientists is sunk. These are the things that all come together to take us from DEFCON 5 to DEFCON 1. And as I was reading it, I'm very well aware of what's happening in the world at the moment and what's happening with the Russian troops massing on the Ukrainian border. And increasingly, the rhetoric is getting heated up and the threats of, what will happen should Russia invade Ukraine. And it seemed to me that what I was reading fictionally was very much in tune with what was happening in a part of the world on a daily basis and has been for several weeks now.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true. I mean, fortunately, it's fortunate for the credibility of my story, but unfortunate for the human race. And I agree with you completely. What's happening in Ukraine now is very like what happens in Never, and it's equally dangerous because there's a certain amount of posturing, isn't there? There's a certain amount of countries doing things to show that they're willing to do something. And so the Russians, just to appear tough and strong, they send another 100,000 soldiers to the border between Ukraine and Russia. And now the West, the Americans and the European Union are saying, if they invade, we will totally disrupt the Russian economy. And there's then the question, of course, nobody's quite sure what that means and how effective it will be. But nevertheless, the question then is, well, if we did that to the Russians, what would they do next to us? They might have, they probably have got computer nerds in Russia figuring out computer viruses with which to infect, you know, the entire American economy, or you know, every fire station in the United States, or something like that. They've got, you know, they're thinking ahead the same as we are. So they're thinking of what can we, if they do disrupt our economy, what do we do to them next to show that we're not going to put up with it? And it's that sort of mentality, we're not going to put up with it, so we're going to do something back, which you see again and again in Never, don't you? Every time something happens, the other side says, right, we've got to respond to this. We can't let this pass. We mustn't look weak. That's what politicians always think, and they think that because we, the people, want our politicians to be tough. We want our country to be strong, don't we? We want to think our country is strong. Our leaders.
Well, I want my country to be moral, not strong, quite frankly. But there we go.
Well, I'm asked sometimes, John, what can we do to change this situation? We live in this dangerous situation. What can we do to change it? And the best answer I can come up with, and it may not be that good, but it's all I've got, is instead of saying to our politicians, be tough, we should say to them, be smart.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been getting messages from listeners, Ken, as we've been chatting, and obviously, I mean, your books make impacts on people, and Pillars of the Earth, I think, is still your best-selling book, and people, you know, Grant wants you to know that Pillars of the Earth was given to him when he was in his early 20s, and the next destination he went to was Salisbury Cathedral. Justice told me that as a 16-year-old, he made up his mind to study architecture after reading the Pillars of the Earth. He did get into architecture, but he found he had no design chops, so he's defaulted to being an accountant. And this is the impact that authors like you, you know, we say best-selling, but it's also kind of best impacting on readers' consciousnesses and readers' memories.
It is very interesting, and it's very flattering, of course, for me when people say that, because, as you say, it's testimony that what I've imagined has had an impact on them. And I do get... I met a young stonemason who said that he had never thought of becoming a stonemason until he read the Pillars of the Earth, and that made him want to do the job, and he trained and qualified and was working as a stonemason. He gave me a little sort of ornament that he'd made out of stone, carved himself. It's tremendous. It's amazing to have that sort of impact on people's lives. Another thing people say a lot about books is they say your novel helped me through a very difficult time. And I think when people are going through something, some sadness or some illness perhaps, and they need something to take their mind to a different place, then a good story can do that. And I get quite a lot of people write to me and say, it was a good book, and B, it came to me at a time when I really needed something like that to help me get through what I was living through. It's very moving when people say that to me.
Well, let me say to you that it was a very good book, and it helped me, and I'm sure it will help many others to deal with the complications and difficulties of a world in the grip still of the coronavirus pandemic. And thank you very, very much for making time available to talk to us. We're very, very grateful. Ken Follett is the author of many books. The latest is called Never.